Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast spotlighting some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. Ingrained in her since she was a child, justice and equality matter most to Jill P. Carter. Jill is the daughter of prominent civil rights activist Walter P. Carter, and she now serves as director of the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement. Before joining Mayor Catherine Pugh's administration and taking over the office in January, Jill served as a state delegate for 14 years. She takes over the Office of Civil Rights at a pivotal time. The office oversees the Civilian Review Board, which investigates complaints against police, though police don't have to heed the board's recommendations. Additionally, the creation of the Civilian Oversight Task Force was one of many police reform measures mandated under the consent decree reached between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice, and part of that task force's job will be to assess the Civilian Review Board. If that all sounds a little jargony, don't worry. Jill talked about feeling marginalized in the House of Delegates, taking over an underutilized office, and some of the early experiences that shaped her. Unfortunately, because of a technical issue, we lost the end of this interview, so I had Jill back to the studio to answer a few more questions, and you'll hear us pick back up. Here's our conversation. What is your first memory of activism or civil rights?
My first memory of activism or civil rights definitely is from when I was a child and recalling the few times, because it didn't happen very often, that I recall that I was able to go out on the picket lines with my father, who was a civil rights leader. And so I do remember, in particular, I remember a protest against then Morris Goldsecker for slum housing practices. And that's one of the last protests I actually remember before my father died. So I remember the day very, very vividly of the feeling of walking with a bunch of people holding a picket sign and holding my father's hand. So that's my first recollection of any of it. My sense of it at the time was that, well, you know, I had a bit of a false sense, because you know, as a child, you think that your reality is the reality. So I always kind of thought as a child that everybody was on board with this whole civil rights thing and this whole equality thing and ending racial segregation and predatory practices and discrimination. I thought like there's like a select few people who don't get it and we're protesting them, but the majority of people are on board with this. And of course, I did grow up and realize that's not necessarily the truth.
Yeah, how did you come to that realization? Just living life.
I think the first time it hit me was Loyola College. Loyola, now Loyola University. I went in the 80s as a freshman, and that's where I graduated undergrad. And I was invited to have a scholarship there because my father had done so much work with the Jesuits and had been a professor there for a short time. And so I did get a scholarship to Loyola. And Loyola is a school, Catholic school, that had only accepted females, women, in the late 70s. And so I'm there in the early 80s. And so the way I used to explain it to people is, so the only other black people here besides me are like the guys on the basketball team, and they get a lot of special treatment. So I'm just like completely irrelevant. I was made to feel very irrelevant there. And that's the first time that I got exposed to a whole lot of people. One, that white people who had never really had encounters with black people, who didn't know of black people like me or like my family, and who the only encounters they had were people that were providing some type of service to them.
So did you feel that you had to unfairly kind of represent your race when you were in that scenario?
We're also talking about those ages between like 18 and 21, where you're kind of finding your way and there's a whole lot going on. So I don't think that I felt that way. I think I felt at the time like a little bit superior. And this is, I know this is unusual. I didn't feel inferior. I felt superior. I felt superior because I had this background where I understood that I believed, I mean, in the core of my being, that all people were created equal and that, you know, equality was everything. And so the idea that there were still white people in Baltimore City in college with me who had a different view, who still looked at things through a lens of racial superiority and white supremacy, I thought they are so clueless. Like, how do they even exist on the planet? Like, don't they get it? Again, it was then that I realized that it was more prevalent than I had believed up until that point. And of course, later on coming out into the world, I then realized that, you know, we have a much further way to go than I knew earlier. But I will say that I began to, through my time at Loyola, find it very difficult. Even though I felt like initially, like, what's wrong with these people? They don't get it. And I think that I was more like showy. Because again, you're talking 18. I'm like, so I thought that I had this great father. You know, he was very cool to me. I thought he was a good looking man. He stood for civil rights. And it was very popular when I was growing up to be for civil rights. You had Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and all these great, great men. Thurgood Marshall, who stood for civil rights. So, of course, to have a father that's kind of like in that realm is something that you really feel proud of. So, I don't know, how do I explain? Over the time of kind of things happening to me, and I don't know if I should go into it, but it was going through the process of Loyola was very rough. So I don't know if I'm even supposed to say this on the air, but from the beginning of my time there, I remember the first mixer that I went to at Loyola. I was actually chased back to my dorm by some drunk guys who were calling me a Chinese nigga whore. I know, this is kind of off subject, but I'm trying to get to like where, how this whole evolution kind of took place. So there became a time that I began to feel very disenchanted with the place. I began to feel unhappy and very angry about the whole situation and about racial discrimination. And it was racial discrimination first, and it was gender discrimination second, because again, Loyola didn't have women until shortly before that. So there was very much a kind of a spirit of the school at the time that came from the administration down, and not the head, because the head was this great guy, Father Selinger, who is deceased now, but you know, the person at the head isn't always representative of the mentality of all the professors and the like. Also, let me just say, Loyola had zero black professors when I was there. I had not one black professor the whole time. So I felt like this is a very hostile environment, and I can't kind of wait to get out of here so I can get back to real life and real people who, like, get it. But
do you think that kind of hostile environment further inspired you or motivated you to pursue civil rights?
I think maybe, but in some ways, perhaps, but I feel like even at that point, I didn't really know. I felt like the only thing I can recall feeling is I wasn't happy, but I feel like it's important to stick it through. One, that competitive nature to show that I can do anything that, you know, I put my mind to. But I felt like because the struggle was so great, I wanted to make sure that I got the degree from here. So I had to stick it out. And then when I got into the work world or the period of time, so I didn't do well. By the way, my grades were not very good at Loyola. So I felt like my options were then limited. And I had gone in being supposedly a bright student. And then I came out kind of feeling like maybe I'm not so smart. I didn't do very well. And I thought my choices are limited. So I decided to apply for jobs, of course, and then I didn't get them. I didn't get any. There was no like really, really great job out here waiting for me. And I remember feeling a little bit of resentment, like, you mean I went through all of that to get this Loyola degree. And at the end of the day, I'm still coming out and I'm still a black girl from Baltimore and nobody's really dying to hire me. But of course, you know, so I said, well, if I can just get accepted to law school, then life will begin. And I think truly, to answer your question, it was probably law school where I began to feel that education is providing me with the tools I need to deal with issues greater than myself, like discrimination and like justice. So that's where I really believe I began to recognize my passion.
What kind of impact did your father's legacy have on you?
Well, I think that so many, everybody kind of sort of knows that, you know, your family is your reality. Your family represents the world to you. So the fact that he died so early in my life and that he was so big, you know, in the house he was big, in the community he was big. I grew up in the city of Baltimore where throughout my life, I recall the norm being people realizing Walter P. Carter was your father. Oh my God, he was so great. And even to this day, I've had so many people, their reactions about him is so passionate and strong. Many people have cried at even recalling their feeling or their experience of working with him. So for me, though, it was, wow, I don't have a father. How in the world can I learn how to be great when he is not here to teach me? And I want to be great because he was great. Because when you know, many have said that your father is the first man that you fall in love with. So I feel that was true. And so I wanted to, one, I was inspired to always try to be good at everything or be great at everything or excellent, because I wanted to always make him proud of me. And then also I wanted to be like him.
Was it ever stressful kind of having that legacy to live up to, or was there any added pressure in that regard?
No, I don't really think there was, except for my mother, who was always stressing to me that we come from a somewhat public and prominent family, and if you do something to embarrass us, you're going to be embarrassing your father.
So thank God you didn't have social media, right?
Right. So yeah, no, the big thing was don't do anything to embarrass us. That would be horrible.
So what brought you to the House of Delegates?
So, I got into law school. I finished and I was working in law, and I began to work with a group of minority contractors, mainly African American contractors, and much of what they worked on was this concept that they weren't getting equal opportunities or fair opportunities. And so there came a point around 2002 when it was time for the elections. And it was suggested to me by persons in the group, namely Robert Clay, who was the head of the group at the time, who's deceased now. And he was my mentor in learning about contracting and minority MBE law and all that stuff, that I run for the House of Delegates. And so my first reaction was, heck no. I don't even really like, I'm not very self-promoting. And then two, I don't really like being forced to go out into the public a lot. Like, I like to just kind of do what I want to do. I liked, at that time, I liked to go to the gym, I liked to go to the spas, I liked to read a lot. And I like to kind of like just educate myself, but I didn't really love just being in the public. And I think that is something that stemmed from my earlier roots. You know, I felt like when I was a child, everything was about substance. Everything was about fighting for something that's right, a cause greater than ourselves. And then it seemed like when I was an adult, everywhere I went socially, like everybody just wanted to like have a good time, and it was boring to me. So anyway, my reaction was no, heck no. And I went ahead and was kind of pressured to file. And so this is kind of interesting. I filed for the House of Delegates like 5 minutes before the deadline at 9 p.m. on the last day that a person could file. And I did it because I felt pressured and my intention was to withdraw. And then the next day I woke up and I had several people that called me that I like and respect. And they were saying, oh my God, we're so excited. You'll be a great delegate. And I'm like, you're kidding. Really? You think so? And truly, I was kind of like, I don't really know what a delegate really does. I mean, I know what the legislature is, but I don't really know what it is going to require, what it's going to entail. And so again, I just kind of a risk taker. So I went ahead with it and I campaigned and I talked to, at that time, my mother had a best friend named Vera Hall who had been on the city council. She was like one of the few close up and personal politicians I knew. So I called her and I said, hey, do you think I should do this? And she said, well, ask yourself one question. And this is funny because this is how she phrased it. If a miracle happens and you win, is it a job you actually want to do? And so I said, lawmaker, policymaker, yes, that is a job I want to do. So I went and shockingly, we just ran a really heavy campaign. I think a combination of things came together to make it just work. And it kind of was a miracle because I got elected in a 2-month campaign, hadn't ever had any real aspirations to be in politics. And I was number one, as many people like to talk about. I kind of shook up the system, some say, because I wasn't a part of any ticket or team. I just came out there and ran and won and got a lot of votes. And so the rest is kind of history.
I know you've said that you felt sometimes marginalized when you were working in Annapolis, and I was hoping you could tell me more about that experience and about your 14 years in the House of Delegates.
I know, marginalized for 14 years. That's a long time,
yeah.
Right, to take abuse. But so one thing I have thought about is I feel like a lot of earlier experiences I had where I had to like persevere through a lot of resistance, like Loyola, And then law school, not so much in terms of I didn't feel discriminated against in law school, but I did feel, it, I mean, it's challenging. Everybody knows law school is challenging. And then I didn't have much money. So the challenge of having to figure out how to have enough study time and balance the work life too. So it hadn't been easy for me at that point. So when I got into the legislature, but you know, also I come from that old school kind of mom training that says, you know, no matter what they throw at you, kind of always maintain your dignity and your integrity and don't let them see you sweat. And so, and then also I come from another kind of old school about how girls are supposed to be raised in, you know, I was born in the 60s. So, you know, that you are always supposed to be polite and you're never supposed to be loud and boisterous and, you know, have a foul mouth. And I didn't always follow that one rule, that foul mouth thing, but I was always, the idea of being loud, boisterous, overly aggressive was always something that was very shunned in my upbringing. And so I did, that becomes interesting because I feel like that had a lot to do with how I was able to endure the legislature. Because some people have said, you know, when people are throwing darts at me and stuff, I just kind of sat there and took it. And so some people have asked, how could you do that? And I don't know. I think it's a lot to do with the upbringing. But I also feel like I'm sort of learned to become a strategist. And so I always am plotting, like, well, I know I can't win this battle here, but maybe if I keep my mouth closed and keep working, I'll be able to ultimately win the war. So I think the legislature is this place where I was like shocked. Like, wow, really? First of all, I was the only black female attorney in the House of Delegates and the third ever in the history of the state of Maryland elected to the General Assembly. And that becomes important because we're talking about a space where there has not been a lot of women or black women or black women with voices, with independent thought that can articulate, that can think their way logically through a situation and then articulate it and are willing to do it. And so a combination of things. I was younger than many, some say fashionable and attractive. I had the legal training and I was politically independent. I didn't come from no one got me there but the people. So I was beholden to no one, which gave me a kind of a courage and a kind of boldness that actually, as I found out, was very threatening. The whole establishment there, it really hadn't been done that people were elected without being chosen, you know, to be on tickets or picked by the machine or some machine. And so that was threatening in of itself. And then the fact that I was willing to speak up on things. And I'll tell you, I went there thinking, and the group that I was working with thought, well, you're going to stand up on MBE issues and MBE law and make sure that we get a fair share. And that was the thought process. But I got there and like I was hit with all these things. And I'm like, you're kidding. Like, you're really kidding me. Like, so when I first got there in 2003, Thornton had just been passed. But shortly thereafter, Judge Kaplan came out with a ruling. He was the lawyer in the Bradford case, which basically was the foundation that Thornton was based upon. And so I initially like put in legislation to mandate the Kaplan ruling that even with Thornton, Baltimore City Schools were being still underfunded, and I was shocked at how I couldn't get support for that. I put in a bill to get the lead out of the water in the schools, and I couldn't get that passed. I put in a bill to get an elected school board, couldn't get that passed. I mean, I couldn't get anything done. And it was put to me like, well, maybe if you weren't so offensive to people, maybe if you did a better job of making friends, maybe if you're more likable, that you could get some things done. But I partially bought into that. There was a time when I tried to tone myself down a lot and focus more on ingratiating myself with people that, you know, I don't know why they don't like me, but I'm going to make sure that they get to know me. I'll have meetings and go to dinners and stuff with some of the colleagues to make sure that they see that I'm not really a bad person. But I found at the end of the day, all that was bull. It was nothing to do with any of that. They didn't like it when you try to shake up their way of doing things or push the establishment rule. And you're looked at as a threat, as a problem, as a troublesome presence. I always say I was the troublesome presence in the legislature for a long time.
Well, you're on Female Trouble, so that's fitting.
And so, yeah, that's what happened. Some say, well, you were before your time. But, you know, I think what's really sad is that we call Maryland a progressive state, but a black woman attorney who is from Baltimore, that knows a lot of the issues, that knows, you know, I never put up forth any issue that I wasn't sure that was right. I didn't just, you know, go around grabbing at straws like, oh, let's try this. No, everything I put in, I really believed in. And I thought I was there to right wrongs, and I found this is an environment that doesn't want to right these wrongs. They have no interest in righting these wrongs. Lead poisoning is something that, come on, you guys, whoever, you know, the fact that it hasn't been addressed, it hasn't been ended in all of these years is an abomination. And so that simple things like that, I would think and say and try to push for, but I was told, you know, even there were even times when like legislators that wanted to ingratiate themselves with the speaker and the establishment leadership, didn't even want to sign onto my bills because their response to me was like, they don't want to get in trouble. You know, the speaker doesn't like you. And so one thing I think is really interesting is that oftentimes I was told, it became a thing where throughout the years, I was told that the reason that some of these major pieces of legislation, expungement legislation was a big thing for me, expungement of non-convictions. You have not been convicted, so you should be able to clear your record. And there's still some impediments to that, even to this day. So, but I was always given, well, you know, the speaker doesn't like you. Well, if only the speaker liked you, if only they liked you, you might be able to get this done. So it was always kind of put on me, like it was incumbent upon me to make this group of people like me, that only had a feeling about me that they were never going to like me. They were never going to like anybody that was going to push through. But I think the more important thing and the more telling and scary thing about the way our General Assembly is run and probably many institutions like it is that it should never be a thing that someone that's charged with doing what's right could hide behind another legislator not being liked. And what does that mean anyway? Like, we're not there to like each other. Like, what is that? And I was very surprised by the small-mindedness of this whole institution. It never changed over time. It never got better. There came a point in my latter years where many of the issues that I was pushing for became subjects to be addressed, to be talked about. You know, there was expansion of expungement law. There was there's still ongoing efforts about lead poisoning, but they've still not done the right thing with lead poisoning. But something I was thinking, the whole law enforcement stuff, the policing stuff. You know, I was treated like a legislator non grata or a crazy person or like a really bad person for even addressing some of these issues with the legislation for like independent trial boards and just better training for law enforcement officers on use of force and things like that. And then near the end, once the Freddie Gray homicide occurred, then suddenly the legislature was ready to act because of the uprising. So they started taking on some of these issues. But at no point, But largely in some efforts with the law enforcement stuff to the exclusion of me, the person that had been championing it for a long time. So just I don't even know if I have a conclusion or a point to it. I just find it very disturbing. And I always felt like it's not about me. People should be outraged that a legislative body can focus so much on personhood or personality and not on issues and you know, just do the right things. People should actually be outraged that lead poisoning is still something that the leadership of the General Assembly first views through the lens of the Property Owners Association and their views before the poor victims and children that are being poisoned and you know, having their lives destroyed because of it.
For all the reasons you just described, you have in a lot of ways positioned yourself as an outsider, a political outsider. And I'm curious about your relationship with Mayor Pugh, because many people describe her as an insider. That's a lot of, I think that was probably praise and criticism she got leading up to the election. I was wondering if that tension ever makes itself known between you two.
No. Well, first of all, we've got a short time that we've been together. She appointed me as Director of Civil Rights at a time when the Department of Justice came out with a report that said, that attested to something that we already, many of us knew, that I'd been knowing for a long time, that the Baltimore Police Department's practices were unconstitutional and that they needed to change. And then the consent decree is signed, and it's the right time to begin to seriously look at how we can improve civilian oversight, how we can give civilians more authority over the law enforcement bodies that are charged with serving them. So it's the right time and the right person. And I think the issue here is Mayor Pugh. My experience of her when she was a senator was she always seemed to be about the business of getting things done. You know, she was one of the rare people in the legislature that didn't get involved in personality. And, you know, she was kind of, so here's what we have in common. it's not about the person or the personality. It's about the issue. Like, there's no permanent friends or enemies in politics. It's all about getting the issue. And so she was very, very focused on being successful and getting her issues done and getting her bills passed. And so she was the type of person that was going to work with anyone to get those done. And there were some issues that we worked on together, and I've talked about those before, like prisoners' rights and the like. She was very big on giving entrepreneurship opportunities to people that are in prison, because we know the obstacles they have when they get released and they can't get jobs because of their records. And so that's something that I give her a lot of credit for. And, you know, I don't know. How do I say? So far, things are going very, very well. But I think it has a lot to do with the right time. It's the right time for me in this position.
Were you ever hesitant to take on an office that's often overlooked and often underfunded?
I wasn't, because, one, I was really, really, really ready to get out of the House of Delegates at this time. I just felt it was toxic. I was beginning to really assess what I was doing with my life, and I looked at the fact that I had gone in 2003 pushing for a bill to get expungement of non-convictions to end impediments to subsequent to expungements of non-convictions. This is one of many, but I'll use an example. And here we are in 2017, and it wasn't done. I looked at the fact that our Baltimore City Public Schools are still underfunded, and now it's starting to come out that Thornton funding wasn't adequate, and there's still issues with that. And I think that the ACLU and others need to go back to court in that. That's my opinion. But I looked at, wow, what are you really doing with your life? You're staying here because you think you fill a space that needs to be filled with your voice, and you have a voice for the people that is, you know, unfettered by political interest. You're not going to put the politics of this place or political interest above the people, and that's needed here. So, but at a certain point, is it worth playing the martyr? If you're not really being effective, like at the end of your life, do you really want to say you sat here for all of these years and this stuff never happened? Come on. So I wanted to just do something that was going to matter. I believe, and maybe I'm just optimistic, I believe that because of the consent decree and because it calls for a monitor and because it calls for a civilian oversight task force that was just appointed yesterday, I believe that there's no way that intelligent people of goodwill could look at the current civilian review board and not do everything in their power to increase the authority and increase the resources. And so I'm here to help advocate for that. And I think, so I'm not concerned about the past, because I think it's going to get much better in the future. And I want to be a part of that. And I think that my experience in the legislature and as a practicing lawyer, I think all of that really prepared me for this particular role at this time. And then, of course, we don't only deal with that. We also deal with discrimination. We deal with discrimination complaints. And we also deal with wage enforcement, which is making sure that persons that work on contracts in Baltimore City are paid fairly.
Would you agree with the criticism that the Civilian Review Board has been largely ineffective in the past?
Absolutely. I was one of those critics. When people would talk to me about the Civilian Review Board and when I was in the legislature, my response would be like, oh, God, please, let's talk about something that really matters. I felt like, because I knew that at the end of that in any administrative proceeding with a police misconduct, that if there's an investigation that sustains it and the police officer winds up facing discipline and opts for a trial board, for example, I knew that the Civilian Review Board has absolutely no say whatsoever. There's no requirement whatsoever that the Civilian Review Board's recommendations are adhered to or even weighed in the balance of that ultimate decision. And so my focus, and it's now largely the public narrative focus, was how do we make sure that those trial boards and that working within IAD, that there's civilian input and civilians have authority and power to work within that. So that became my focus, because I thought, until and unless you find a way to make the Civilian Review Board's recommendations count, so they could be resourced all day long, but if the law doesn't require that the police commissioner adhere to their recommendation, they're completely irrelevant. So that was my view of the Civilian Review Board. And they also, come on, it was created under Martin O'Malley's administration, and I believed that there was no mayor that was in the city of Baltimore that was ever committed to making this a valuable, worthwhile, meaningful entity. So I now believe different. I believe Mayor Pugh is committed to that, and I believe that it's the time, so we're going to do that.
What would, like, in a perfect world, what would the ideal Civilian Review Board look like and do and have the power to do?
Wow. Well, first of all, I believe that it shouldn't be limited to being called a civilian review board. It should be civilian oversight of policing, the whole concept. And that right now the civilian review board is limited to 5 different areas of complaint. Those areas are false arrest, false imprisonment, harassment, abusive language.
I can't remember.
Excessive
the fifth
force.
Either.
The big excessive one. Force. The biggie.
Yeah.
And we have to rely upon what information internal affairs sifts through and decides is relevant and that they then forward on to us. Now, we've come a long way because as of July 1, a couple days, there's no more requirement of a notary on a civilian filing complaint. And there's also an expansion lifting the 90-day statute of limitations for filing a complaint to 1 year. Sorry, I said that really fast.
That's okay.
So those are some slight improvements in the process. But we've already been kind of working better together since I've been there anyway. And because of the consent decree, I don't think it's just because I'm there, because they feel BPD is committed to greater transparency and working more collaboratively with the civilian review board. But we're still not able at this point yet to just take the information as it's given, decide for ourselves what is important. And when I say ourselves, I mean the board, what is important, what is relevant, and then collect all of that evidence, you know. So one of the things that we're working on right now, and actually met with IAD, and I have good news, they've agreed and has Commissioner Davis agreed that we will be able to designate civilian people, are not the board members, but our investigators, to be able to obtain information that they deem relevant and sift through information without having to just be having IAD determine whether this is relevant or not and then handing it to you to look at. That's one thing that has to happen. The second part of it is we should be able to, and we do have the light statutory authority to look at policies of the it's not just BPD either. Civilian Review Board has authority over 5 different law enforcement agencies within the city of Baltimore, and housing police, the school police, the sheriff's department, the environmental police. So basically, to look at the policies and practices and actually make recommendations for how they should improve. I believe that we should not be contingent upon IAD to spoon feed us information. We should be able to start from beginning to end with an independent investigations. I also think that we should be able to look at policies such as something that's been heavily in the news, you know, the use of overtime, the use of patrol officers and those kinds of things, and make recommendations that are adhered to, not just, you know, oh, they made a recommendation. Like, there's a lot of really beautiful reports out there, but if nobody, you know, has to follow them, it doesn't matter. So I think robust, complete, and total oversight, I think that's the goal. There are impediments to that right now, but LEOBR would have to be modified. We can't get around it. It's been modified slightly, but it needs greater overhaul. And I think that the Civilian Oversight Task Force, I'm very much hopeful that that will be among their primary recommendations. And at the end of the investigation, the biggest thing I already talked about is if Civilian Review Board sustains a finding against an officer and IAD does not, right now there is a person that the police have hired. He's a retired judge, and he looks at the IAD file and the Civilian Review Board letter and makes a determination as to which one was correct. And more often than not, that weighs down on the side of the BPD. That process should get better. It should change. There should really be either faith in the decision of the Civilian Review Board, or there should be a neutral arbiter of the two decisions that looks at everything, the whole robust file, not just one file and then the other a letter.
Hindsight is difficult, of course, but do you think after Freddie Gray's death, the outcomes would have been different if the Civilian Oversight Task Force had been in place, for example?
Well, I think so, maybe. Well, here's what I know. So Civilian Review Board only still gets stuff when a complaint is filed. So if no complaint was filed, there was no investigation into any of the officers' actions around Freddie Gray. In an ideal civilian oversight board, we would be able to take on that investigation regardless of whether it's initiated with a complaint, right? It should be able to be like, oh, this is an issue we need to look into. Perhaps it should be across the board any allegation of excessive force or any appearance of excessive force, or perhaps it should just be everything that we could look at anytime it affects the public. But I think that had the Civilian Review Board been able to investigate, perhaps there could have been administrative sanctions or greater transparency in that process. They wouldn't have had to take it over to Howard County and Montgomery County because I want the public to think about something. So the Commissioner Davis, who I believe is of goodwill in this, told us that he took the administrative part over to Howard County and Montgomery County to avoid any appearance of impropriety. Well, what about all of the cases? Why just this one? You know, would there not be that same issue, the appearance of impropriety in investigating all of your own cases all the time in other instances that aren't so public as the Freddie Gray homicide? So I just feel like we should look at that, and we should always have this mechanism where the Civilian Oversight Board in Baltimore City, made up of civilians that live across the city in Baltimore, they're committed to thoroughly vetting these cases. I think that's something that should happen, and I do think it would have been different. I do. I don't know about the trials and the prosecution, but I think administratively we could have been quicker, swifter, and more transparent and more open, and probably produced some fair results.
I'm back here with Jill Carter. Jill, thank you for coming in again.
Thank you so much.
I think we last talked about the death of Freddie Gray and its impact on your work. It's probably very difficult to quantify, but to what extent do you think the death of Freddie Gray impacted the Office of Civil Rights? I know that happened before you came into the position, mm-hmm. but to what extent do you think that has influenced the work that the office is doing?
I think that it gave the office the foundation that it needed, or it possibly is the springboard to further the interest of the office. Under the office, of course, is the Civilian Review Board, which reviews police conduct, misconduct allegations in five different categories, including excessive force. At the time of the Freddie Gray death, the Civilian Review Board did not automatically receive all of these complaints, and now it does. So, you know, and when such cases happen in the future, there's a much stronger chance that the Civilian Review Board will have an opportunity to review these serious misconduct cases that may not have had a chance to in the past, and they may conflict with what the IAD's findings are. And so that's something that we're looking to push forward. The Department of Justice report and the Civilian Oversight Task Force, the consent decree that calls for a Civilian Oversight Task Force and a monitor, I think all of those things are going to work in the favor of the people of Baltimore, and that is strengthening a Civilian Review Board. Of course, our office has other agencies within it. In addition to, we deal with anti-discrimination with the Community Relations Commission. We have the Wage Enforcement Commission that makes sure that, well, seeks to make sure that everybody in Baltimore is paid fairly and properly. And then also, we just recently acquired the Commission on Disabilities. So there's a lot of opportunity in our office to bring more fairness, equal access, equal opportunity to throughout all of Baltimore. I think that with Freddie Gray and, of course, now probably the Trump administration, I think both of these things highlight the need for local, strengthening local civil rights venues. And so I think it's the right time. I think it's the time to really focus in on civil rights. We are having an annual breakfast coming up, and we just decided that our slogan would be the fierce urgency of now, because we really believe this is the time. It's kind of now or never to right some of the wrongs in Baltimore. There's a lot of past discrimination residue or residual ravages of past discrimination in Baltimore, segregation, and Freddie Gray, lead poisoned. Baltimore and Maryland have never gotten serious about righting the wrong of lead poisoning, and so one of the first things when we think about Freddie Gray is that we should focus in is that in 2017, how many children are still being born in Baltimore that are allowed to be lead poisoned because the legislature will not require property owners to abate their properties of all lead before renting them and then hold them accountable.
I know you mentioned you were worried that some people, you know, now more than 2 years after Freddie Gray has died, will think that the work is over, or, you know, we have the consent decree, everything is okay now. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I certainly hope not, and it is a big fear, because people are not expressing their outrage, their rage, and their anger in concerns about Baltimore in the streets, that because there's this appearance of silence, I'm hoping that doesn't translate into apathy. What all of that was, in my opinion, it should have been a springboard to right the wrongs of the past of Baltimore and correct a lot of the legacy of the disparate legacy of haves and have-nots. And so I just really believe my office can be kind of a catalyst to sort of help some of those things bring them into fruition. But one of the things that's critical right now is the consent decree is a floor and not a ceiling, and that there's an opportunity right this moment for the public to go right on the city website and give input into who look at the choices of monitor and decide who should be the monitor. There's a chance right now for the public to reach out to the Civilian Oversight Task Force that's been recently appointed and express what a real civilian-led policing operation would look like, or what real, genuine civilian oversight would look like, and make those recommendations. We still have a long way to go, but I believe that with the help of the people, the monitor, the Civilian Oversight Task Force, we could make the legislative and policy changes that are needed to give real meaning to what the Civilian Review Board does. And actually, you know, we need to change the way we think about policing anyway, and about what civilians' input and participation is in it. Police work for the people. People don't work for the police. And so at the end of the day, the final word on how policing looks, what the policies and strategies are, and what officers are allowed to get away with and not, should be something that is determined by the people, not the police.
You haven't been in this position for as long as you were in the House of Delegates yet, of course, but are you still frustrated by the kinds of roadblocks you described facing in the House of Delegates, and do you feel more effective in your new position so far?
I have a great lot of hope in my new position, one, because the mayor appointed me knowing my full history, and so I have to believe she wanted someone that would be strong and push the envelope on these issues to make the city better. So I do feel more powerful. I felt very marginalized in Annapolis, and so it's kind of interesting because I was thinking about the fact that we get very excited, and I'm happy that we do, because it helped me, when we see a woman or a black woman or a relatively young woman or black woman running for office or seeking a position of power. But once, no matter what the high hopes are, once that person gets indoctrinated into that system or that institution like the General Assembly, there's very little opportunity to make real change. And so when we look for women, black women, minorities, people that have traditionally been closed out of certain circles of power, what we should be seeking is to help strengthen them, not just in the course of the campaign, but once they're actually elected to office or appointed to the position, because they can't do it alone, and the system will still crush them if they are standalone. They must always have the support of those people. And so I'll say one of the things that I found in Annapolis, and thank God, I was so thankful that people elected me, because I always say it was the greatest honor of my life, and it was that people actually picked me to represent them. It was amazing. And I knew that it was a privilege, and I took it very, very seriously. The responsibility of it, I took very seriously. But when you're in there in the halls of Annapolis and you got the weight of Miller and Bush on you, the people aren't there because the setup is not that. And so it was very, very difficult to do a lot of that heavy lifting in that system that was structured in such a way that legislators are rewarded for how well they get along with the leadership and punished for what they do to challenge it. And so I would just say that we've got to, when we look at this idea that many people support of more women getting into positions of power in politics, we've got to actually make sure that we continue to provide that same level of enthusiasm and support that we do at the beginning and the onset in the campaign when they actually achieve the position. Because I'm just in a testament to the fact that you can't do it without the support of the people. And it's just structured in Annapolis in such a way that it's not conducive to reform. It's not really conducive to women in power. I mean, there's never been a female or a black Senate president or House speaker in the progressive state of Maryland.
And I think that also kind of touches on the problem of tokenism and why you need more than just one woman in a position, more than just one black person, right? Because then it can be a negative and you are kind of crushed by the expectations of those systems, right?
It can happen, absolutely.
How much or how little do you think Baltimore has changed since the time of your father's activism?
Well, that's a loaded question, and I have a feeling that, well, of course, in many ways, the city has advanced a lot, but racially, the city is still very divided. I saw it as a delegate in the 41st District, which is actually, I think, one of the most, if not the most diverse districts in the whole city of Baltimore. It's the highest voting district altogether. It has the most diversity of wealth and poverty and everything in the middle, and then in neighborhoods of poor, middle class, and well, socioeconomic status that is the higher levels. So, example, it goes from Lower Edmondson Village to Upper Roland Park, which is like Windhurst, which is the really wealthy area. Then you have the middle areas of the kind of middle class blacks, like Howard Park and Ashburton. And then you have some poorer areas, like the lower end of Edmondson Village, for example. And not a slight to any of the communities, but you saw a great disparity in the level of citizen participation, but also credence given. How do I say, like certain communities had more weight, not with me, but with the delegation generally. So to get back to answering your question, I'm sorry, I got off on that. So I can say that the city is still extraordinarily divided. And I think that the only way, if we have any real interest in ending some of the gross disparities where we're divided socioeconomically and racially, we have to be intentional and aggressive about doing it. So we have to be willing to take on strategies to reverse the patterns of segregation and housing policies that were anti-black that have created the disparate neighborhoods that we have. I don't see a true legitimate will on the part of major part of political leaders to do that. But I do think it's something that is pushing its way through progressive people and some younger people in the city at the present time. So if we are intentional and aggressive about fixing these things and focusing on these issues, I think we can really make a difference. But it's the truth is, it's still a very, very segregated, disparate, unequal city.
You've talked about the frustrations that come with working in politics and dealing with bureaucracy. What keeps you motivated to kind of do this kind of work?
Oh my goodness, that's interesting. I don't know. I think it's the DNA. I do know that for some reason there's this ringing mantra in my head that I feel like I heard my dad say or came in a dream when I was a child or something, that you never stop fighting, you never stop trying until you're dead. Like, when do you stop fighting for what's right? It's always time to do what's right. There is no greater issue in this whole world than fairness for people. Why in the world would we push people to do things, to be good people, to get jobs, to get education, to contribute to society, if at the end of the day they're never going to be able to be treated fairly as other people that have traditionally had more privilege or power? That is insane, and it's an unfair way to be, and I just have always struggled with that. So I think, honestly, it is true that when I look at systemic discrimination or systemic racism, it's troubling, and I don't like it, and I've always, since I was little, wanted to fix it. But I've had some personal experiences that have really shaped me, and so I can go back to thinking about when I struggled at Loyola, which was a racist and sexist institution, when I went there in the 80s, and I pushed my way to, I forced myself to stay in it to get the degree. But coming out of it and not feeling like, and I was surprised because, again, I grew up in Baltimore, I grew up in Ashburton, a relatively black middle class neighborhood. I did not experience a great deal of discrimination until I went to Loyola. I also grown up with this father, this reputation of a father who was somewhat of treated as an icon because he was deceased. So I thought I would be treated pretty fairly, that I would have a lot of opportunities. But I can remember coming out of Loyola and feeling like, wait a minute, where's all these people that like knew and loved my father to offer me jobs? I have my degree. Like, when are these things going to happen? So I can just honestly say that I think that it's blatantly unfair to expect people to do everything they can to realize their potential in life, and at the end of the whole thing, there's no real opportunity waiting for them. You know, there's ceilings on what their life can be. And so those are things that I have that are the driving force for me in the whole in my life. And then I think, you know, for some reason, it's always been kind of inherent in me to think, what difference does it make? Because a lot of people have said to me over the years, like, I walk around not smiling, like, why don't you smile? It's all good. And I'm like, it's not all good. Don't you know there's like all these problems? But I also feel like at the end of my life, is it really going to matter how many days I was happy? Or is it going to matter how much impact I had on the society around me? Did I use my life to make it better for the people that come after me or and are here while I'm here? That's what's really important. And so I don't see any other point really to life if you're not using what you were given to create a better environment for other people. So that's the driving force, I suppose.
Thanks for coming, Jill.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can listen to Female Trouble everywhere podcasts are available, like iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you listen on iTunes, it would help us out if you subscribed and gave us a rating. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.